Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro.
I'm Alicia García Herrero.
And today we will discuss China's macroeconomic outlook in this closing of the year and projecting ourselves for 2022, as this is the last episode of this year, part of Bruegel's focus on global China as seen from Europe, which includes our monthly newsletter, Zhonghua Mundus, to which we invite you to subscribe. The link is in the show notes. Joining our conversation today is JP Morgan Chief China Economist, Haibin Zhu. Hello, Haibin. How are you?
Hi, I'm good. Thanks for inviting me.
Haibin, thanks a lot for joining us. You are joining us from Shanghai, so that's particularly appreciated that we have managed to make the connection today. Back to the topic of today's episode. China's economy has already peaked cyclically and is expected to slow down by the end of this year. Things this year seems not to look as bleak, however, because key support was the strong external demand. However, the internal demand kept weakening, causing a steady decline in manufacturing sentiment. It has been an eventful year for China and the world, and we have seen during our several conversations in this podcast different aspects impacting on the economic outlook, from the pandemic to geopolitics, passing by the internal politics and its more recent tough regulatory wave on the tech sector. Haibin, could you perhaps tell us your summary of this 2021 when it comes to China's economic outlook?
Yeah, if we summarize what happened in 2021, I would say there are two expected developments and two unexpected developments. So two surprises, right? The two expected components. One is that 2021, China is the first one to exit the policy stimulus, which is not surprising, right? Because last year, China was the outperformer, the first major economy to return to pre-pandemic growth path. So naturally, China will first consider policy exit. The second in line with expectation is 2021 is also an important year for China thinking from a longer term perspective. They announced the 14th five-year plan, the 2035-2049, the new development strategy. So we also expect for this year, because of the growth pressure is relatively lower, they will put a lot of focus on the economic transformation, right? The particularly more green developments, more innovation, and more balanced between efficiency and equality. So this is actually what we see throughout this year. But the two surprises, one is that the magnitude and the scope of the policy normalization and the wide range of industry policy shock all happen simultaneously. That's well beyond the market expectation. So of course, that led to the economic slowdown, but it also led to the second policy surprise that since July, starting from the RR cut, clearly the governments were aware of the downward pressures. They're trying to manage the risk. However, in the last 3 or 4 months, I would say the policy adjustment is behind the schedule. So I think these are the two surprises, actually, both on the policy front, much broader range of the policy tightening, led to the downward pressure and also the failure to turning around the momentum very quickly as they did in the past.
Alicia, what is your first reaction to this summary?
Thanks, Haibin. Yeah, indeed. We've seen a lot of policy action after the first quarter, especially in the summer and then thereafter, from tech crackdown to many other sorts of crackdown, of course, even the real estate sector, in my opinion, all started with basically regulatory measures, which go all the way back to August 2020. So indeed, a big chunk of the slowdown does come from policies. But still, if you look at, you know, consumption, disposable income, which I think is in a way less related, because to me, the crackdown, the biggest effect is on fixed asset investment, which, of course, is very obvious. But my question really is whether you also see kind of a hesitance, if I may say, to consume in China. Because even in the best of all times, first quarter, you still didn't see that, you know, as a major support, which in a way we've seen in the West. maybe because the West had fiscal measures that were more geared towards consumption, that it might be, again, a policy response. But I'd like to hear more about, you know, the consumption side of things from you.
Yes, China has a very unique recovery pattern. As you mentioned, that consumption service recovery has been much lagging behind. But the normalization in the production happened much earlier and much more forceful. And this is very different from the rest of the world. And the reason why consumption is lagging behind, of course, is related to the recurring local outbreak and also the COVID zero policy that keep on dragging the process of the consumption recovery. But putting that aside, I would say the more important fundamental factors, one is the household income growth. And the second is the household saving, right? There's an abnormal behavior after pandemic period. If you look at these two, I think household income growth is a key driver behind the soft recovery. Because unlike most other countries, the Chinese government, in their post-pandemic fiscal stimulus, there's very little transfer to the household sector. So taking U.S. as a good example, right, about half the fiscal money actually goes to the direct handover to the household sector. So household income didn't decline. Instead, it should even jump up after the pandemic in the U.S., which in China's case, income declined, but also saving rate spiked. So that explains why the consumption starts from very weak position. At this stage, if you look at the same thing, or the same income growth actually has been recovering steadily, saving rate also start to very close to pre-pandemic level. So for next year, I think the question whether China, see how much room China consumption will further recover truly depends on how much room the income growth will recover. Without government subsidy, the fiscal transfer, it really depends on the labor market condition. I think for that, there's a big debate right now because official unemployment rate actually print a pretty rosy picture that the survey based on unemployment rate now is 4.9%. But based on our ground feedback, we have good reason to be more cautious in that area, particularly a lot of sectors being affected by the industry policy shock this year. We see actually a rising trend of the wage cut, underemployment rate, or even unemployment rate. So I think that will affect the income growth recovery going forward, which is the reason why we believe that consumption will continue to recover, because it's still there's a shortage, there's a permanent scar at this stage compared to pre-pandemic past. So it will continue to move up, probably in real term, 4-5% range for next year. But probably compared to pre-pandemic past, there will be a scar there, which is not only temporary, but last for a few years longer.
A follow-up question on this, Haibin. I don't want to touch yet the whole aspects related to common prosperity narrative, because that's a huge chunk. We also dedicated a full episode on this. But is there anything in this common prosperity narrative, practically speaking, that for 2022, I mean, not what we've seen so far, in your opinion, is it going to be used for this recovery of consumption, these households, trying to rebalance the economic side on the household side? Or in your opinion, this is just going to leverage on the other parts, which we've seen already, like the crackdown on the tech and the more difficulties we've seen on the big private conglomerates and so on?
Yeah, common prosperity received a lot of attention for this year, but it's a misperception to think that this is a new wording. First, China is a socialist economy, so common prosperity is an intrinsic part of the economic system. Of course, the different at different stages, the leaders have different interpretations. So policy implementation will have different focus, right? But if we talk about the current, the trend, common prosperity, trying to reach some balance between efficiency and equality, I think that change actually, it didn't happen start from only this year. It started to happen about one decade ago. If you look at, say, more measurable economic indicators, for example, labor income as a percentage of GDP, household consumption as a percentage of GDP, or the Gini coefficient, right? All this, if you see very clear pattern, actually around 2010 to 2012, that was a period actually we see is a directional change in the trend. So, for example, before 2010, the labor income as a percentage of GDP continued to decline, same for household income. But after that, actually, they start to pick up. Right. And also, this was a period that the government put much more focus on expanding the social security system coverage in the last 10 years. So actually, this not only started to happen for this year, but of course, it has been reinforced under President Xi in the last 5 to 10 years, and furthermore, actually, for this year. But if we ask me, say, what policy measures is most critical to achieve the common prosperity, particularly from the fiscal side, there's a discussion what measures the government can adopt in the primary distribution or the redistribution or third distribution. Right? This has been a topic thing in recent months. My interpretation is that at least in the foreseeable future, the primary distribution channel measures will continue to dominate. So that include that continuous increase of labor income as a percentage of GDP that relate to the division between labor income and capital income, right, in the GDP. But also in China's case, the other two policies are critical because if you talk about China's inequality, we're not talking about income and wealth inequality. They were also talking about the inequality between rural and urban areas and also regional inequality. And for that part, actually, there's already written down policy measures like regional development plans and also what they call the rural area revitalization program. So this is already on table. I believe in the coming years, this will be a more effective measures to achieve the common prosperity objective. For the second or redistribution measures, mainly related to government fiscal transfer and taxation. And again, if you compare to the European countries, there's a lot of room for China to improve, to use the taxation and the transfer to reduce the inequality in the country. But this, I think, will take longer time. Introducing new taxation is not that easy.
Sorry to interrupt, but in the short term, that's more my question for 2022. In the European economies, we've been seeing a lot of support for consumption, also linked to the recovery plans of the pandemic and so on. In your opinion, is there something like that that is going to happen in order to sustain consumption and encourage Chinese people to spend more on the retailing sector, linking up to the discussion you were having before?
Yeah, I think that's probably one of the major policy caveats. If you ask my own opinion, I think the Chinese government, they should introduce more subsidy to the poverty household families or the affected family by the pandemic. In reality, probably they will not, and they will continue not to do that. And one particular reason, I think, is probably related to China's unique experience in the poverty reduction efforts. Remember, that's what actually happened in the last 5 to 10 years. And the policy lesson from the poverty reduction is that instead of, say, giving money directly to the poor people, you should create jobs, training their skills. And that's a way that they are able to earn salary and support themselves. That's a more sustainable poverty reduction. I totally agree that from the poverty reduction perspective, that's probably more effective. But in this particular time round, actually, when we talk about a public health crisis, right, which a government should actually provide more fiscal subsidy direct to the household sector. But I would say the previous policy lessons has so heavy impression that start to actually affect their current policy decision. That's probably the most important reason why it didn't happen in China.
Yeah, I mean, it's good to reflect on why China takes decisions and, of course, its own history, its own economic success in a way. It explains a lot of the hesitance, as you mentioned. I quite agree with you that it might not be enough this time, though, because first, growth isn't as high. It's basically less than half. So, you know, you're not going to create the same amount of income to be naturally distributed through job creations. And as you know, there's also this rebalancing towards services going on, which means that the new jobs might be first less productive because a lot of those services are not, you know, high productivity services. It might be delivery, it might be, you know, and it's actually quite similar to what we've been experiencing in Japan, to be frank. And that is not a high wage environment. So you may still not have, say, poverty, but you may have underwaged kind of society. And I think that's very hard to solve without fiscal transfers. But you're right. President Xi's speech, I think it was 15th of October, if I recall correctly, on Common Prosperity, makes it very clear that there's no such thing as welfareism, you know, for China's future. And I have to say, as a European, I can understand that they may think that our model perhaps was too generous, you know, so they don't want to err on the side of excessive, quote-unquote, generosity. So in a way, they are kind of, I wouldn't say trapped, but trapped in the sense that they had a good experience and maybe ours has been perceived as a bad experience and therefore they are very cautious. But frankly speaking, I think if there is a time for which European welfare has shown its benefits, maybe not overall, but this is COVID, because that's where you have all of these automatic stabilizers. And the question is, can you do that for, you know, kind of special times? And I guess China has hesitated to do that for special times. And that's where we are, I think.
Thank you to both of you, because that clarifies a lot what's going on this realm. But this brings me naturally, because we speak about the pandemic, to the other big elephant in the room of 2021, but especially moving forward to next year, which are the effect of the zero COVID policy on the economic outlook. I mean, definitely also on consumption, since we've been speaking quite a lot on consumption, but on many other aspects of the economy, including global value chains and you name it. So I would like to hear a little bit more on that. And what's your projection, your expectations for the next few months on that policy and how it's going to evolve?
Yeah, I think China probably will stay as an outlier of insisting or continue with the COVID zero policy, while the rest of the world gradually moving more and more towards living together with COVID policy. Right. So unfortunately, that means for international travelers, actually, we are facing more a segmented world. Right? Advanced economy as a block, actually, which the first stage of the reopening with each other. China is the more segmented. And the other EM, depending on the pace of the vaccination, they will probably later join the first group, right? But at this stage, we're talking about probably three different blocks. And the reason why for China more likely to stick with the COVID zero policy, of course, to some extent, is related to China's success in controlling the pandemic situation on the domestic front, right? But I think there are also two other very important reasons. One is the social perception toward the COVID. Unlike in the US, European countries, most people seem to accept that COVID is a more severe flu, right? And they care more about the severity illness or the hospitalization squeeze and or the death rate. But in China's case, people are still very scary about any increase of a new infection number. So I think that from the tolerance level of the society, China and a few surrounding economies, the tolerance level is much lower. But more important, from economic perspective, of course, the COVID zero policy, as I said, the recurring episodes will continue to drag on the domestic consumption and the services recovery. But from external front, it's very hard to argue that China will benefit from border reopening. Because if you look at this year, exports was extremely strong. FDI increased double digit compared to a historical level last year. And also service trade deficit narrowed by more than 100 billion this year. So you need to think about what China will benefit. For me, it's not obvious, but it's running the risk. And then risk is that more on the domestic front. If you reopen the border and the new infection cases climb up quickly, then domestic audience will get panic and they will stay at home. Domestic consumption, at that time, we're not talking about fumble. It will collapse. So that's a huge risk.
Haibin, I hear you and I fully understand. And frankly, Omicron hasn't helped because in a way it confirms this strong view that the world is not ready to open. So, but you know, I really want to bring here the kind of unintended and sometimes obscure but relevant negative consequence of the zero COVID policy. So we are seeing huge exports, by the way, because others were also closing down, Vietnam, you know, like it's kind of a combination of China remaining opening domestically and many others actually closing domestically. So the combination of that is great news for China. Let me clarify just in case that, of course, I don't mean to say it was intended. It's just the way it is. But the problem with this model is that you feel very comfortable in your own little, you know, it's not little, China is huge. Other countries are actually in much worse situations because they are smaller economies. And therefore, countries or economies, you know, we could talk about Hong Kong or Taiwan or whatever. But the point is that in a way, the long run impact of that is that why do I need the world? Why do I need the world? And that's so dangerous economically. Let's forget about many other things we could discuss. Because, yes, if you need to keep your investment, say, in Chile, yeah, and you made a big one, and you just happen not to be willing, frankly speaking, to go there, that investment might actually get sore because you're not following up. So I don't think we're fully seeing, you see, the negative consequences of this. We're seeing the positive, which is actually related to the rest of the world not leaving fully COVID restrictions. But, you know, at some time, and it's good that, in a way, ironically, good at least for that model for China that we're still there. And again, it's Omicron is pushing the curve. But I still think that the longer you remain this way, the harder it will be to then jump on the world. And for me, that's a big risk. Yeah.
Yeah, Alicia, I totally agree. I think that if you talk about downside risks, this is a walk, actually, that China's losing the interaction with the right words, the talents and the knowledge. I think this is a probably not directly measured, but it could be actually a longer-term, medium-term damage. But second is that what I observe is that because China is so successful in the domestic public health measures, but it relies heavily on a very strong government and also the support from the general public, which is very difficult and probably hardly to imagine in many other countries. But the risk is that because of successful in the domestic epidemic control, the government may misleadingly think actually this is a superior model, the social governance model. And then this sentiment may further evolve into the other areas like economic policy. They rely more on the administrative measures. That's more another, I'll say, the potential downside risk, which of course even more difficult to measure. But in practice, actually, at least at some local government level, we do see actually this happening.
Moving to another topic, which of course is related to some of the stuff we said before. We mentioned common prosperity, and I intentionally didn't want to touch yet the crackdown wave, which has been attached to that in the past few months. But now is the time where I would like to dive a little bit deeper into what to expect next year after this first crackdown wave. Also considering the fallout of the Evergrande case, which we can debate if it's more of a symptom or of a cause of the wider concern on this realm. So what is your forecast on that side of the story?
For the tech regulation, if we consider this year as the first half, which means that the introduction of the new rules, then next year we'll probably enter the second half, which means that the pace of new rule introduction will be much slower, but it more focused on the implementation. But the bottom message is that it's not over. This will continue. And this tech regulation, of course, the regulatory changes in part is because the regulatory catch-up, because China's internet sector booming in part has been benefiting from a less or even no regulation environment. So there's a catch-up with the global standards. That's part of the story. Second part of the story is related to common prosperity, a review of the business model, antitrust, and a review of how to balance between firms' profit maximization and the social responsibility, talking about the protection of workers' rights or consumer rights. And of course, on the top of that is also national security concern, data privacy, data management. So that's the driver behind these the regular changes or new economy sectors, which means that it doesn't mean the government is going to crack down the digital economy. Actually, the policy is still very supportive for digitalization. Government spend a lot of money, continue to support the infrastructure like cloud business and the big data. And they still perceive digitalization economy is a future trend, but they want to make sure that the new rule now be set up and everybody need to play according to the new rule book. So I think for 2022, for the tech sector, it's more a policy implementation and the business model need to be adjusted to fit into the new framework.
I mean, we've seen already that some big companies like Tencent and you name it, they've started to move into investing more heavily on cloud computing and other stuff, which reflects what you just say, like more infrastructure. But my question, if it might be a very straightforward and simplistic, are we going to see in 2022 a new video game license released in China at some point of the year? Or are we going to say completely goodbye to video games licenses?
Well, I'm not expert on that area, but I think, it's not the end of the game. I think the game license will resume, although I'm not in the expert position to call for the timing. But again, that it happened also in 2018, remember, right? That the suspension of gaming license, which almost lasts for 10, 11 months, and they eventually resume.
So it's more like a strategy for reorienting the economy? Or, I mean, we know the narrative that is attached to this. It's about also the protection of children. And, you know, there are some elements in the narrative that also resonate with some of our privacy regulations or our regulations of big tech here in Europe. So that's why I'm trying to understand the logic, if there is an economic motive as well, you know, and what is the economic motive besides the political narrative part?
Yeah, I think if we put in the bigger perspective, you also mentioned the Evergrande and the property market, right? And as I said earlier, that industry policy shock also cover many other sectors, decarbonization related, education, right, healthcare. And also if you mention the other areas which receive policy support, right, the green investment, technology upgrades, high tech, rural area revitalization, these actually are the areas to receive policy support. So the policy, particularly industry policy, has a bigger influence on the economic dynamics for China this year and probably also going forward. And that's probably also the biggest question, right, from the market perspective. Is it only temporary or is more structured? My sense is that it's probably more structured. It represents a policy regime shift from high growth to high quality growth. Government has a very strong opinion that how the economy should evolve by, say, reducing the reliance on the global demand, fostering on the domestic market, the so-called dual circulation theory, right? And also that to increase the self-sufficiency on the supply chain, innovation, investment actually should rotate away from less productive, for example, housing investment, to more productivity, high-valued sectors investment. From in the past, actually, the sector was a high environment cost to more green investment. So these are clearly actually in the government's mindset and agenda, and now actually they're forcing into the policy practice. So in that sense, a lot of the industry policy shock we saw this year, as I said earlier, they're not going to be relaxed or reversed. They will continue. We're talking about fine-tune in the policy in these areas. If they're talking about how to address the near-term, the cyclical downturn pressure, I would say they're mainly relying on the macro policy, fiscal and the monetary policy as a kind of cyclical instruments. So actually several years ago, we labeled actually this is under this new policy framework, we're going to see the separation between macro policy and the industry policy. Industry policy more serving for the longer term goal, and the macro policy will be used as the kind of cyclical instruments.
Well, Haibin, that's good to know. That's basically what the world does, at least the developed world. So it's good to know that industrial policy will not be used as a counter-cyclical tool, because it creates a lot of excess credit, excess bubbles and things that are unwarranted. So that's good news. And on your note on the structural shift, and again, in this podcast, we want to focus on 2022. What does it really mean, say, for emissions? What does it really mean for the private sector? I mean, these are two different topics, but I'm just saying they're relevant because to me, that structural shift somehow will put additional downward pressure on 2022. So that the stimulus that you mentioned and that I'm also hoping for, to be frank, so that we get a nice figure for next year at a time where, you know, the rest of the world is slowing down, at least the developed world. And, you know, it would be nice, frankly, to have at least 5% from China. But I just worry about that structural shift affecting negatively that expectation that we all have, that fiscal and the monetary stimuli will make it to get there. So I'd like to hear from you, Will they delay or will they not be as pushy on this structural shift on quality growth to have a smooth transition? Or should I then revise my forecast for 2022? So it's a very pragmatic question.
So here I think that for 2022, the government will face in a bigger pressure for meeting the growth targets. This year, we know the growth target was very conservative. No question they can achieve that. That also explains why actually the magnitude of the policy tightening in the number of areas. For next year, I think if you ask me, say, how the growth driver will rotate compared to this year, I'll say if you look at expenditure sources, export contribution to GDP will come lower. I think that shouldn't be a surprise. Within investments, manufacturing investment will continue to outperform. Real estate investment will further slow down, the biggest dragging factor for the economic performance in the foreseeable future. Infrastructure investment probably was sitting somewhere in between. But momentum-wise, we will see some improvement compared to the very poor performance for this year. So question is more on the consumption, right? Consumption, if without any major surprise, we're forecasting probably only at the beginning, first quarter of next year, because of the Lunar New Year and the Winter Olympic, there might be some travel restriction prior on domestic front. So that should be a negative period. But then afterwards, we're basically repeating the same story for this year, right? There's some recurring episode, but overall consumption continue to recover. So if we put them together, I think from the policy side, of course, the policy will finish the tightening episodes, but we don't foresee policy will shift from tightening to easing or stimulus. Instead, we're looking at rather neutral fiscal and monetary policy. And to some extent, it's because of the policy regime shift, as I mentioned, because if housing policy, the other industry policy doesn't change the course, it's very difficult to even think about, say, fiscal or monetary easing, where the easing will come from. I think it's not that easy to deliver as much stimulus as you want to be. And the other is also the incentive issue, whether the policymakers truly want to shift toward the stimulus. And if we listen to PBOC and the fiscal authority, I think overall, they're still more on the cautious side, avoiding, say, a big shift rather than they want a gradual adjustment. So, of course, in the near term, we have two events to watch out to assess the policy stance. One is the Central Economic Working Conference, which will happen every year in December. And the second is the March next year, the MPC meeting, which will lay out the next year's annual targets. So, of course, a lot of things will probably happen in the next few months. And that's still that we can assess how the policy will react to the latest economic developments.
And Haibin, for sure, here at The Sound of Economics, we are going to closely monitor this and we might come back in the first months of 2022 to see what happens to some of the stuff that you just mentioned. We are slowly going towards the end of this episode, but we cannot close this conversation without a mention of what is going to happen with everything related to the climate emergency and decarbonization in all these big pictures. You mentioned it, I think, once or twice. So I think for our listeners, it's going to be very interesting to understand better how policies announced ahead of COP26 and the US-China deal, how it's going to mold the next few months of the policy in China on this and how this is going to impact to the economy at large.
Yeah, so China made the longer-term commitment to achieve carbon neutrality by 2060, roughly 10 years later than most other developing countries. But I should mention that it's still very challenging for China to achieve that. Because if you take the time between carbon emission peak and carbon neutrality, there's only 30 years for China to complete that process. In Europe's case, we're talking about roughly 50, 60 years. So the pace of change is quite dramatic. Of course, there's a certain technology China can probably learn or borrow from others, but that is a challenging task. Of course, it also means a great new investment opportunity, right? Particularly for this year, we see new energy cars. Actually, these are the booming sectors. And our research analysts estimate that in the next 30 years, China's green investment could totally actually in the next 30 years could exceed 100 trillion renminbi. And that's a huge number, right? So it's an area that we see the huge opportunity, but also we see that the near term and or even in the medium term, the transitional period pain. If you move, say, too aggressively without, say, a breakthrough in the corresponding technology, then it will have a negative impact on your economic. That's a transitional cost. So on the policy side, I think they need to balance. And of course, it also involves, more importantly, the change in economic structure. So China right now produces about 28% of global carbon emission. Right. That's higher than China's GDP share, which is about 17-18%. But if you compare with China's manufacturing, the share in the global manufacturing, that's roughly in line, 27-28%. So I think if China truly wants to reduce the carbon emission, I think eventually we need to talk about continue pushing economic transformation from manufacturing to service sector and to consumption and service, and also from high energy consuming to low energy consuming sector. And that's exactly actually we see it has been for this year.
But then I have a question to Alicia, if I may. If China would transform itself into from manufacturing to service sector, looking more at the global economy, who is going to produce the goods that we need?
We won't need so many goods. So actually, I think it's a great outcome. We have 50% of global emissions coming from supply chains, which don't seem to be working very well lately. So I'm all for it. I basically think that's a problem of less importance than continuing to produce these massive emissions, if you ask me. And you know, the world is adjusting. I think the consumers are increasingly aware, and that will be in itself sustaining mode because demand will change. And I think that that's good for China in a way to realize. So the digitalization of China's industrial production is also, you know, a way to reduce carbon emissions. I think we're all kind of realizing that we need to change. That's all.
And on this note, of course, we could keep discussing for hours because this is extremely interesting. We need to, unfortunately, close this episode, which is also the last episode about Global China as Seen from Europe, part of our series linked to the monthly newsletter Zhongguan Mundus, to which we invite all of you to subscribe. The link is in the show notes. Also, as usual, I would like to remind you that you can read in open access all the analysis by our scholars on our website, www.bruegel.org. Haibin, Alicia, thanks a lot for joining this conversation.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
And thank you to all our listeners for following us. Until next time, bye-bye.